from KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. A national TV gardening show produced locally premieres tonight. You'll meet the host and top staff at Sacramento TV company, The Idea Factory, today on Insight. Also today, did you know breast milk can be donated and banked? The Sacramento region has its first milk donation center. Guests you'll meet include a mother who's donating milk. And the great veteran jazz saxophonist Sonny Rollins. He talks about his restless musical search to do more and to do it better. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, mothers with more milk than their baby needs can donate some to a milk bank. You'll meet people involved with Sacramento's first milk donation center, including a donor. Also, a conversation with jazz legend Sonny Rollins. He plays the Mondavi Center tonight. First, a Sacramento TV company has made a name for itself producing shows for cable TV and broadband. The Idea Factory's newest program premieres tonight on the DIY network. The program is called The Dirt on Gardening. In a few minutes, we'll meet some top staff at the Idea Factory, but first, joining us by phone is the host of The Dirt on Gardening, Christine Hansen. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey. How are you?
Excellent, thank you.
Good.
Now, some of the shows that I see on DIY and HGTV and so on are hosted by people who don't seem to me to know too much about the subject at hand. What about you? Are you really a gardener, or is there someone behind the scenes that tells you what to say?
Well, actually, that's how Peter and Lynn and I were the producer and also the idea man behind the Idea Factory came together, because I am a gardener. And having been in television meteorologist for 30 years, I have over the years been able to landscape and give people my unsolicited, at times, advice on gardening problems or ideas. And that my name came up in a conversation with Peter Holmes, and he was looking to produce a show on gardening. So it actually came through people who have used my gardening services. And, of course, I followed that up with training through the Master Gardener Program at the University of California, Davis.
Now, I'm quite familiar with you on TV, sports and weather,
yes,
in Sacramento and in the Bay Area. Were you always secretly hoping to unify TV and gardening?
It has been my lifelong dream to somehow combine these. 15 years ago, I married a man who is a vintner and lived in Mendocino County, and that gave me a perfect opportunity to move up to actually have a blank, you know, canvas to sort of just define and refine my skills in gardening. We had vineyards, of course, but we also farmed biodynamically and organically. So I was able to establish habitat breaks in our vineyards, which draw on beneficial insects, as well as develop an acre of lavender and additionally add animals life to our gardens, which is a type of Rudolf Steiner gardening. So I was able to do that over the last 15 years, and I thought, nobody's going to hire me to be a shepherd or to sell dried flowers and, you know, not do really well at that as far as finances are concerned, but it certainly was an opportunity that led me back to Sacramento and, of course, to this show. So everything comes together in life, and this truly has been a dream come true.
What's the format of the show?
Well, it is a studio set in a nursery. So we are in a nursery with a potting bench, and that is where our set is anchored. However, we venture out into other areas of gardening. Certainly, we have zone tips from all over the country, so we cater to everybody in the U.S. as a national show should. We also try to highlight some of the wonderful gardens and around Northern California. We have gone into Gardeners of Chefs. Tom Keller, who is a very famous chef from the Napa Valley, we've explored in there. We have taken specialty gardeners from the area, people who may be out seeking cuttings, for example, on a rose, and we show people how they do it, share some of the passion. There are so many gardeners in the world. Every one of us is a gardener. If you have an indoor plant or just one single outdoor environment, and you have an interest, so we have really channeled it to attempt to capture a wide variety of gardening specialties, and it's really a fun show to watch.
Christine Hansen is host of the new TV program The Dirt on Gardening. It premieres tonight on the DIY Network. Let's bring in our studio guests, including Lynn Margarita, who's supervising producer for The Dirt on Gardening. Lynn, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Jeffrey, for having us.
How did you figure out what the format of The Dirt on Gardening would be?
I think when we started, Peter and Christine and I sat around and tried to figure out what would make an entertaining and educational show, and what the direction we decided to go after was interacting with real everyday gardeners. So the show takes questions from people via email, or we go to gardening shows and record questions from gardeners, and Christine answers those questions in a format, as she mentioned, at a nursery, and shows if you have a problem with aphids on your roses, how you can treat them. So we thought that would be fun to be on location at a nursery and just talk to people and find out what their questions and concerns were and educate them through the show.
There are so many gardening shows on TV, not just on DIY, but on other networks too. How do you set about trying to figure out a new way to entice people to watch another gardening program?
Well, that's the hard part about producing television, is so much has already been done. And a lot of it comes from the host themselves. We have somebody new and unique. Christine is new, you know, on DIY. And so using her energy and her information, you know, that's part of producing a new gardening show, but then truly finding something that's different. And we came up with something that's in every show, and it's called Here's How I Do It. And basically, those viewers who are asking us questions, we then turn the camera on them and let them share with us tips and tricks and showing off part of their gardening, so and their garden. So that's kind of different and something that I haven't seen too much of on gardening shows.
Also with us is Peter Holmes, who's president and partner at the Idea Factory. He's one of the two founders of this company. Peter, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
How long have you been doing this?
We opened the company in October of 1997, so almost 10 years now.
And now you do shows for DIY and HGTV. Is that the main part of your business?
That's a large part of our business. We do a couple of shows for what we call the Scripps Networks, which is HGTV, Fine Living, DIY, and the Food Channel. But we also do a local medical show for Sutter Health as well.
I like watching these kinds of shows on TV, and one thing that strikes me about them is that they're always so so tight and predictable, yet not staid. You know, there's something about them that you always know what you're going to get, but it always seems like a little bit different from the last time you watched it. And that, I suspect, is a difficult format to work in.
There's a lot of mechanics to it. There's a lot of art to it as well, and that's what I think we're good at. And in terms of what we do, is trying to find a new way to craft the same kind of information and present it in an entertaining way. And it's always a little tricky to do.
What's the Scripps Networks like to work with? I mean, they distribute this enormous quantity of programming. Do they keep a tight leash?
They do, but as we get into it a little more, as we grow into them and they start to trust what we do, we get a little more leeway with a little more play with that leash to run and experiment.
What's the key to making a successful program like The Dirt on Gardening or any of the shows that you see on cable networks like HGTV and DIY? Lynn?
You know, that's tough because there's so many channels now and there's so many choices for viewers to pick, you know, television, what to watch every night. And, you know, what we talked about earlier is finding, I think now you see these networks like Food TV and DIY. They really want a host, a talent that people trust but are engaged and entertained by. So it's the total package of trying to find that special star that can deliver, be somebody you want to watch. If you're flipping channels, you'll stop when you see that person, but then also learn something and stay put. So, you know, we're doing a lot of that now as we're developing other shows. We're looking even to people here in the Sacramento, Northern California region to find those new stars, whether they're cooking chefs, gardening, home improvement people. We're looking for people, and that's, I think, the key to what makes shows different now, because pretty much everything's been done. If you don't have a fresh spin on an idea, then you really do need to look for that new rising star.
Peter, when I introduced Christina, my first question to her was about how some of the hosts you see on these Scripps networks are more like personalities who are drafted in, and others are not. And Christina obviously knows her gardening.
Right.
What do you think works better? Is it better to get someone in who's a really accomplished personality and who's given a script and just cranks them out, or is it better to get someone who also knows what they're talking about?
Well, that's a real it depends question. For the DIY network, they really like their host to be informed and knowledgeable, because that's part of what they're building their reputation on. So they can't really go to the glossy side of television, because their hosts really need to know their stuff. So that's pretty critical. For some other networks, it's true, they might want a little more eye candy or flash and less substance.
Christine, the Dirt and Gardening premieres tonight. What's on tonight's show?
Well, I'm going to refer back to Lynn. I'll tell you why, Jeffrey, and that's because we shot these quite some time ago, and
yes,
I was trying to recall today. I thought, what is tonight's show about? Because we've had a lot of publicity and people wanting to talk to us, and I said, it's been so long ago, I can't remember. So
okay,
we've covered so many things, and they're all fabulous, but Lynn, what are we talking about tonight?
And also the network looks at all the shows that we deliver, and they say, we'll put this one first, and
yeah,
a lot of times we don't find out until, you know, last minute. But tonight, it's one of my favorite shows. I think Christine's too. We start off with Christine. She teaches everybody how to plant hanging baskets, which is something that people with small spaces, if you don't have a big garden, there's a right way and a wrong way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So she demos that, and then we have a wonderful package where we go, as Christine mentioned, to the French Laundry, the restaurant in Yountville in the Napa Valley, and we interview Chef Thomas Keller at the French Laundry about their culinary garden. So,
tough assignment, Christine.
Yeah.
I know. Oh, isn't that terrible? And, you know, you get to talk gardening all day long,
yes,
with these people. It's fabulous.
Christina, give us a tip on hanging baskets, something to bear in mind when planning where to put hanging baskets, what kind of plants to put in them, that sort of thing.
Well, hanging baskets are going to dry out considerably because most of them are hanging under something. And I think people assume because they're sort of out in the elements, we've had all this rain recently, that you don't need to bother with watering them. But if you do have hanging baskets out year-round, certainly water is a very big thing. Also, make sure that you plant, if you're hanging basket may get some beautiful morning sun, but if you planted sun plants and in the afternoon it's got full shade, then you're not going to get the type of color that hanging baskets are designed for, and that's to give you just a little bit of as Peter mentioned it earlier, in the form of a host, but in the form of a plant, eye candy.
Lynn, one of your responsibilities include heading up new programming development. What programs are coming up for the Idea Factory?
Well, and Peter, I don't know how much you want me to talk about. No, as you know, developing TV shows is...
He'll nudge
is,
you if
yeah,
you go too far.
Yeah, it's difficult because one idea is out there and then it's gone the next minute. But we have, as Peter mentioned, a solid footing in the Scripps Network. So we're in development on a fitness show for one of the Scripps Networks. We haven't started production on that, but that's going to happen soon. We just finished taping a special for the Fine Living Network called Winter Wonderland Romantic Getaways, and we used a couple of local talent from TV stations here in Sacramento to host that. We have a couple shows in development, one which I think has a lot of promise, but we don't want to talk about it because ABC just launched a show on a similar topic. We won't say what it is, Simon Cowell, but we're
is that
hoping...
the Inventors program?
So, but we have a lot of irons in the fire, so to speak, and it's great because now that we have the Dirt on Gardening and some other program that Peter's done with the Idea Factory, that we are getting a lot of attention and a lot of ideas.
So you were or are planning a reality-type show about inventing?
it's possible, yes, absolutely.
Good answer.
Yeah, yes.
Were you working at all with the folks at University of the Pacific? We did a show on inventing, and they have a resource center down at Pacific in Stockton about inventing. It was an interesting show. We had this guy on who just had like a regular guy, and he was retired, and he came up with an idea for a camping implement, and now he's off to China trying to find a factory over there and so on. But anyway.
Perfect. That's interesting. And what's that called? Can I write that down?
No, I'll negotiate my finder's fee first.
You want a hosting job?
So the Dirt and Gardening tonight on the DIY Network, and says here it starts at 10:30 p.m., and it's repeated a couple of times over the next few days.
7:30, actually. Yeah.
This must be the Eastern time. Right. 7:30 p.m. tonight on Pacific time. Well, Christine Hansen, thanks so much for joining us
Jeffrey,
today.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for having us.
Pleasure. Look forward to seeing your show. And thanks also to Lynn Margarita, supervising producer for The Dirt on Gardening, and Peter Holmes, who's president and partner of The Idea Factory, which produces The Dirt and Gardening and other shows. Thank you all.
Thanks for having us. Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a bank for breast milk, and later, jazz great Sonny Rollins. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow on Insight, California, America's High Stakes Experiment is the new book by Peter Schrag. He describes the great problems facing California and how the state can overcome them. You'll find more information on past and future insights on our website, capradio.org/insight. Not every mother who wants to feed her baby breast milk is able to produce. Nowadays, there's an alternative to feeding your baby milk formula. Milk donation centers collect breast milk from mothers with enough to spare. The milk is banked and distributed. The Sacramento region has its first milk bank. It's at the Birth Center in Fair Oaks. Let's start with a woman who's donating milk. She's Hosanna Hannaford of Carmichael. Hosanna, thanks for coming in Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you decide to start donating breast milk?
Well, I went into the NICU unit in Mercy San Juan Hospital when my daughter was born, and I saw the preemie babies in there, and you know there were just tons of little babies, and I started reading about it and realized that a lot of those babies, you know, they couldn't get the milk from their mothers for one reason or another, and I just saw how my baby, after I started breastfeeding her, she just was thriving and doing so well, and I read about how many good things are in breast milk that you can't get anywhere else. Formula doesn't have, you know, there are over 100 different qualities that breast milk has that you can't get from formula. And as soon as they said that they wanted to start the milk bank, I just jumped on it because I want to help in any way I can.
Yeah. So. How did you know you had enough milk to spare?
Well, my baby was just getting bigger and bigger. So she was doing so well that that I just knew that, you know, and I just had plenty. You can just tell.
How long have you been doing this?
I just started a couple weeks ago. I think I'm the first donor. Mm-hmm. And we just started it a couple weeks ago. So I started pumping, try to pump every day, at least once a day.
At home, or do you have to?
At home. Yeah. They provided me with everything I needed. They provided me with the pump and bottles and everything that I need to, you know, insulated carrier to transport the milk back and forth, a freezer thermometer, all that stuff so that I can make sure that the milk that I give is, you know, under the right conditions and everything. And
how much milk are you able to donate, say, over the course of a week?
It varies, depending on how my daughter is feeding at the time. But I'd say anywhere from, I mean, it's only been 2 weeks, but I'd say anywhere from 6 ounces to 12 or 13 a week, probably.
Also with us is Ruth Cummings, who's owner and director of the Birth Center, where the milk distribution center is. She's a nurse midwife. Ruth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How much milk? Hosanna just told us she can donate about 6 to 8 ounces, I think. Mm-hmm. How much is that worth for a baby? Is that one day's milk? Is it? Or I have no idea.
Well, you know, I'm not going to be able to tell you exactly how much the preemies will take in a hospital, in ICU. I know the way that they're preparing it at the company Prolacta that we're working with to set up the milk bank. They process the milk that we ship to them, and they prepare it in 10cc syringes that has the specific calorie count of that 10cc syringe. So when it gets used for babies that are in the NICU, they know the calorie count and the volume that they're giving the babies.
Hmm. When did you start this?
Well, Hosanna, like she was saying, is our first mom that's donating. So we're just kind of getting started. Today we had our grand opening for the milk bank at the birth center. So that was fun. We got a lot of our moms coming back that our moms that are lactating at the birth center want to donate. So we're going to have more and more women that are donating. So
how big is the need for this milk?
Well, apparently the need is larger because there are more premature infants being born all the time. They're relating, some of it's related to the high rate of fertility use that people are having multiple births. And so those babies are typically born early. And so they have needs. And sometimes, especially with multiples, I'm a mom that has twins myself, and I know I've done everything under the sun to make enough milk for the both of them, but sometimes I have to supplement. So there is a need.
Why is there a need for when it comes to preemies?
Well, specifically, they tend to do better. They're starting to be known that they will do better with breast milk just because they're much more prone to infection because they're born early and their guts aren't as developed as full-term babies. So they really do benefit from a lot of the things that breast milk can give them that a formula doesn't.
Excuse me, I need to clarify something here. Is this a case where the mother is around but can't produce milk?
Well, it could be numerous reasons. You know, there may be a mom who can't for some reason, whether she's ill, she just doesn't have the supply that she needs, or she's on some medication that she can't use, that they can't use the milk for the baby.
I see. Okay. Hosanna, what do you do with the milk once you've pumped it?
Well, I pump it into special bottles that they provide for me, and then I pop it in the back of my freezer. And I have, like I said, I have a freezer thermometer that goes back there to make sure that my freezer reaches the temperature that it needs to be. So I just pop a bottle back in the freezer, and then when I'm ready to take it over to the birth center, I put it into my insulated carrier and take it over there like a little lunch bag.
And then, Ruth, where is the milk kept? How do you store it?
We have a freezer specifically for that, that keeps a constant temperature and is set up to alert us if there's any kind of glitch in the temperature. It calls me. The freezer calls me to let me know that it needs some attention.
How long can you keep the milk for?
Well, until we have enough to batch to send down south. And so we won't be keeping it probably for longer than a month until we would have a batch to send to them.
What do you mean sending a batch down south?
Well, the way that we're going to package the milk to be sent down there, we put it in a freezer. And so rather than putting just two or three bottles in, we will save the breast milk in our freezer until we have enough to fill the freezer, more so to ship it down to Prolacta.
Okay. Well, speaking of Prolacta, joining us on the phone is Elena Meadow, who's president of Prolacta Biosciences. Elena, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for asking us.
Well, tell us what happens once the milk is shipped to Prolacta. What do you do with it?
Well, once the milk is received at Prolacta, it's scanned in, and we're connected with the milk banks through an online donor center management system. So we know that milk would be coming from Fair Oaks. We know how many bottles are in there, and we know, because they've scanned them in there, we know what particular donor numbers are included in that batch. That's a security measure to prevent an unwanted intrusion into our system by perhaps some milk that's not intended to come into the system. Once we get it, then we scan it in, receive it, inspect it, and then some of the milk is put under quarantine, and some rigorous testing occurs prior to even accepting it for processing. That includes drug testing on the milk to test for the five most common drugs of abuse. Now, we really don't think that our donors are using drugs, but the neonatologists want to know that we've really closed that loop and prevented any possibility of harm for these little critically ill babies.
How long has this system, this method, been around?
We opened up our doors in August, completed the construction of this, but this is the only plant of its kind in the world. It's the only large-scale pharmaceutical-style processing plant just for human milk in the world.
So you're starting, I guess, to build a network that includes donors like Hosanna Hannaford.
Exactly.
Are you finding many takers?
Oh, yes. We already have hundreds of donors. We have about 14 milk banks open now, in some in California and some throughout the rest of the country. And we're scheduled to have about another 15 installed by September. So every town that has sick babies should have a milk bank.
Have you any idea how big the need is nationally? Do you have an idea of how big your network needs to be
in order to
meet needs?
Yes, we do. We focused on the 59,000 very low birth weight babies that are born at under 1,500 grams. They're born as early as 23 weeks gestation, and the normal gestation is 40 weeks. And so these babies, right now, there is just a critical shortage of human donor milk to take care of these babies. Quite often, mom is either not available to pump milk, meaning that she's either ill or she has some social problem like drug abuse or other disease. She may have given birth to the baby and had to go back into jail, and she may be serving prison time. And so this baby, unless they get donor milk, they just don't get the benefit of all the protective proteins and all of the anti-infective qualities that are in human milk.
Mm. Also with us on the phone is Kate Risingson, who's manager of regional lactation services for Sutter Medical Center, Sacramento. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
What do you think about this? Do you have any concerns or things that you'd like to see addressed?
Well, milk banking has been around for some time through the Human Milk Bank Association, and our neonatologists are actually very enthusiastic about setting up milk banked milk for our vulnerable babies in the premature unit here at Sutter Medical Center. They know that babies who get human milk really do have shorter hospital stays, and they're not so vulnerable to all of the insults that can come their way through infections. And just because they're not miniature newborns, they haven't finished growing and developing yet. And nature intended them still to be in the mother's uterus, and because they're born early, human milk is the ideal milk for them.
Has formula come close to replicating human milk?
No, it hasn't. You could compare it to trying to make blood. You know, it's human milk is species specific. Our bodies make the milk, especially for human babies, so its composition is especially designed to produce minimal stress on immature organ systems. And it has it protects the gut from colonization with harmful bacteria. So infections that are devastating for premature babies, the human milk provides a lot of protection. And plus, there are growth hormones in human milk, which enables the gut to continue growing. In premature babies, the rugae, which is the lining of the gut, is very smooth. And with continued administration of human milk, that gut continues to grow and develop. And so it's very important.
Indeed. Elena, does freezing have any impact on the quality of the milk?
You lose a little bit of nutrients, but actually what is more important, freezing has a positive benefit in terms of killing CMV, the cytomegalovirus, which is prevalent very prevalent in the population in general.
Okay.
For normal full-term babies, it's usually not a problem, but for these preemies, it would be a problem.
Ruth, is there any restriction on how a mother can donate milk to the bank? Is there any period of time after giving birth that you can continue to do it?
Well, initially, the guidelines that we had said that women couldn't donate after their baby was a year old. But they've lifted that restriction in terms of we've had two or three women now wanted to donate their milk at the birth center. So we collected, they brought in a sample of their milk. We're going to send it down to Prolacta. They'll analyze it and see if the caloric value of it is still high enough. And if so, then they'll be able to donate their milk.
And just quickly, if someone wants to help, what should they do?
They should get in touch with the birth center, the milk bank.
Okay. So you are accepting mothers who are able to give breast milk?
Right, yeah, now. All the time. Yeah, yeah. Anybody who wants to call us.
Mm-hmm. And there's a link to the birth center on our webpage, campradio.org/insight. Finally, Hosanna, I guess you'd recommend it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Okay, well, thank you all for joining us. Hosanna Hannaford, she's a breast milk donor. Ruth Cummings, owner and director of the birth center. Kate Risingson on the phone, manager of regional lactation services for Sutter Medical Center Sacramento. And also on the phone, Elena Meadow, president of Prolacta Biosciences. Thank you all.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, veteran jazz saxophonist Sonny Rollins. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and next, the great jazz saxophonist, Sonny Rollins. Sonny Rollins is one of jazz's all-time greats, a restless talent. He's famous for continually pushing himself to do more and better. He's worked with many of jazz's other greats like Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis, and Bud Powell. Sonny Rollins has covered many of the best tunes in the Great American Songbook, but he's written a lot too, like this piece, Sunny Moon for Two. Sonny Rollins plays the Mondavi Center at UC Davis tonight. I asked him to think back to the late 40s at the beginning of his career. Could he then have imagined himself as he is today in his mid-70s, still recording, still touring?
Well, you know how it is when we're young. We never think about mortality or anything else. We just do things day by day, and we think that that's how things will remain forever. So, no, I had no idea how long my career would last in the mid-40s, late-40s, I should say, when I first started recording. Why, I was just very happy to have progressed to that point.
You're well known both for recording your own songs and for recordings of other songs by other people. Have you ever asked a composer what he thought of your version of his song?
No, I haven't. Not too long ago, a few years ago, Irving Berlin's daughter sent me some music of her father's, and she had become aware that I had recorded some of her father's material. And we struck up a relationship, a pen pal relationship, and she was very nice, but she never commented on it besides that. And as far as a living composer, no, I never got any comment. However, as a composer myself, I am always extremely flattered and happy when someone else records my material. So I'm never too critical about any. I'm always very honored, really, to have my work recorded by someone else, and I imagine that that's probably how most composers feel.
Yes. Well, the songs you've done by other composers include a lot of the great standards in American music, but you're also known for choosing some songs that are maybe a little less obvious for jazz musicians, like maybe the most famous one is There's No Business Like Show Business. How do you set about choosing the songs that you're going to cover by other composers?
Well, it's just a matter of the melody and the chordal structures of the songs. And sometimes a song will just strike me a certain way, strike a chord in me, if you'll excuse the pun. And then I'll just say, wow, I like that. And as you noted, I'm not too particular about where I hear a song. I mean, I like to consider that jazz as a musical form can absorb so many different forms of music, styles of music. And so if I like something, I can incorporate it into jazz. And there are many songs from various places that I hear that I feel I can use. If I like the melody and the harmony and so on, jazz has no barriers in my way of viewing things.
Is there anything, though, that you typically respond especially well to when it comes to melody or harmony or chord structure?
Well, there probably are some things, but of course, that would be a vast amount of different permutations that appear in music. I'm a sentimental player in many ways. I like sentiment expressed in music. And some songs are prone to bringing out those feelings in me, you know.
A lot of the standards of American music have their origins in shows from Broadway and elsewhere. But when I listen to your own compositions, for example, Sunny Man for Two on Night at Village Vanguard on HS and Plus Three, it seems to me that there's a very strong connection to the blues in the licks that you wrote for those songs. Is blues something that's important to you, even though you're a jazz musician rather than a blues man?
I play a lot of different styles. So when I look for musicians to play in my band, I have to always find guys that are not just good in one thing, not just good in blues, not just good in what we call straight ahead, not just good in backbeat, or not just good in Latin style. I mean, I have to find a musician who can handle all of those things. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes difficult, you know.
What you're saying reminds me of a quote I just read by you in an article about you, and you said, "I'm always in danger of sounding too different than I did in my last record, but it's what I have to do." What do you mean by that, that it's what you have to do?
Well, I mean that my musical prowess isn't that great that I can sound exactly the same all the time. I mean, I think it's you have to be really a great musician to be able to recreate what you do. I've never been able to do that. I'm always trying to. Of course, I'm always trying to change and experiment and get better. You know, I feel I'm more like a work in progress than a guy that's already made his mark and I'm all set. I've never been like that. I'm always trying to improve myself. And consequently, if you hear me tonight, I'm going to sound one way. And if you hear me two nights from now, it might sound like a different guy. Not completely, but enough that it can dash expectations if you're looking for the guy you heard two nights ago. I've experienced that a lot in my early career, and it's something which I just have to live with, because I can't recreate what I did before, and I don't want to, really. I'm not that kind of musician. I'm not that good a musician. I'm a musician that's always trying to reach my own best quality. So I can't recreate what I did. I mean, I'm just always trying to find something better.
Have you ever, based on what you just said, have you ever played a concert, recorded an album, recorded a song where you thought, you know what, that was it. I couldn't have done that any better.
Well, there have been a few times in my long career that I can remember that I was satisfied, or I shouldn't say I was satisfied, but when I felt that I was playing at my optimum. You know, when I'm playing at my optimum, it's not so much me playing, it's sort of the music playing through me. Because jazz is the music, when you're improvising, it's happening so fast that you can't determine where it's going all the time. And it's just a matter of having your methods and everything prepared, and then the music plays itself. So there have been a few times in my career when I've felt that the music has played itself and that it sounded real good. But
can you give an example of that?
An example of that of that happening?
Yes.
Well, gee, you know, I've been playing a long time, and it's been so few times that I really feel that, wow, things really came out right. It doesn't happen often. It used to happen maybe two or three times a year when I used to perform much more than I do now. So it's one of those things. It's an extremely exhilarating feeling, and of course the audience who's maybe a step or two removed from my creation, you know, they would be extremely pleased and everything like that. But I have to be pleased first. I mean, if I'm pleased, then the audience will be pleased. If the audience is pleased, I'm not necessarily pleased.
It sounds like you're talking here about live performances. Did these moments ever happen when you were making a recording?
Well, I have been damned by many of my critics as being a person that plays much better in person than on record. And that's probably true to a certain extent. I guess the test of that would be successful records, which I guess would be successful in terms of how many were sold, in a sense. But I've had a few jazz records which people would consider very successful over the years. But making records used to be easy when I started out and I was playing with Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell, and back in the days with Coltrane and all of those people, because in those days we had the disc, which was, it was not possible to do a lot of the technological fixings that we started doing in later years. So I guess back then we just had to make a record and had to play a couple of choruses or whatever, and that was it.
Yes.
As soon as things got to the point where we could go back and we could edit and we could change our solos and change parts of our solos, that began to sort of inhibit me a little bit. And I think probably think too much about that stuff than I used to years ago. But even that being said, I'm still a person who is considered more dynamic in person than on record. Mm-hmm.
You just mentioned some of the jazz greats that you played with, and there have been many others. Which of all those musicians did you most enjoy playing with?
Well, that's, of course, almost impossible to say. I enjoyed and I learned because I was the junior of all the people that I just mentioned. I learned a lot from all of those people, really. And I was pretty close to Miles Davis. I was pretty close to Thelonious Monk personally as well as musically. And so I enjoyed playing with both of them. All of those people really contributed a lot to my own development. But as I look back, Thelonious was almost like a guru of mine, and Miles was a little more contemporary with Miles. I think Miles was about 4 years older than me, where Monk was 13 years older. So although I hung out with those guys on a contemporary level, I was still the junior partner, so to speak, and I learned from all of those people. But it's hard to say who I learned more from. I learned a lot from them. I learned a lot from the generation before me, Coleman Hawkins, the great saxophonist, Lester Young, the great saxophonist, the people that wrote the book on jazz improvisation.
Yeah.
You know, I was fortunate to play with both of those guys. And, you know, I'm just a very fortunate person. You know, I was born at the right time in the right place. And I realized I wanted to play music as a young boy. And I was able to just be around that bristling music scene in Harlem. And come in contact with all of these great people who really inspired me greatly.
Yes. I read that you started actually playing the piano before the saxophone. Is that right?
Yes, I did. I came from a musical family, and my parents wanted me to start. My older siblings all played. And they wanted me to, they started me on piano since there was always a piano around the house.
I was just going to ask you, how do you think your career would have gone if you'd stayed with the piano?
Well, I think I have a musical gift which I could have used if I had been a piano player. I think I would have been, I don't know if I would have gotten the same heights that I have achieved. Whatever they are as a saxophone player. But even as a young kid playing around on piano and without having taken lessons, there was a noticeable difference between what I would do on a piano and what some of my kid friends would do who also liked jazz and wanted to play. I mean, I always had a certain touch. So I think that if I had remained playing piano, I probably would have been able to contribute something.
Finally, Sonny Rollins, if you had been born in 1980 rather than 1930, what kind of music do you think you'd be playing today?
Well, if I was born in 1980, I hope I would be a person who was aware of the vast history of jazz and the vast history of music in general, but particularly in jazz, so that I think it's important to have a historical perspective in your playing. And if I was born in 1980, I mean, I hope I would be a guy that would be I would know about Fletcher Henderson and Coleman Hawkins and Louis Armstrong. I mean, I hope I would be a person that would be wise enough to realize
Sonny Rollins, thank you so much for joining us. It was a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much for asking me to come on the show. Thank you.
Jazz saxophonist Sonny Rollins, he's at the Mondavi Center tonight. The MC will be KXJZ's Matthias Bombau. You're hearing another piece by Sonny Rollins called St. Thomas. That's Insight for today. If you enjoyed poet Al Young on yesterday's show, you should know that was just the hors d'oeuvres. He was in town for a private event for California Lectures. I was there, and it was amazing. He worked with a jazz band, the Tony Passerell Trio, improvising and bouncing music and poems back and forth. It was a great evening. Of course, yesterday's Insight interview with Al Young is in our online archive at capradio.org/insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, U.S.-led forces in Afghanistan are investigating the recent deaths of two coalition soldiers. They were battling suspected Taliban fighters but may have been killed by friendly fire. That story in the day's news next on The World. Today's associate producer was James Scott. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. Jeffrey Callison on the next Insight. California, America's High-Stakes Experiment is the new book by Peter Schrag. He describes the great problems facing California and how the state can overcome them. Also, a local woman returns from a humanitarian mission in Pakistan and an important milestone for a Sacramento TV station. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.